Okay. My name is Catherine Nicolia. I'm a graduate student at Wayne State University. I'm here with Beatrice Staples, a now retired section violinist from the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Today is November 29th, 2016. And we are at Beatrice's personal residence in Bloomfield, Michigan. Also, Beatrice is my future mother-in-law. So, hi, Dee.
Hi.
Okay. Well, digging in, can we start briefly with some memories from your childhood, as much as you're comfortable with?
Well, I was born in 1938, which is 1 year prior to the official start of World War II. And unfortunately, most of my childhood experiences have been marred by the war. It was constantly in my consciousness for so many years, even during the years after the war. And even today, whenever I think back to my childhood, I hear sirens, I hear bombs flying low, I feel the anxiety rushing down to the bomb shelter. It was anything but a typical childhood, I can tell you that. In more detail, some of the experiences that most stand out in my mind, one in particular, and this is after we have left my home city, where I was born, was in Budapest, and during the years, very often, my mother would take me to the country, where my grandmother and an uncle had an estate, and there I was in safety, because there was no concern that the bombs would be, the flyers would be going there, because it would not have been of any interest to them. So it was mainly in the urban areas where the activity was. But we had left Budapest, and we were on our way north and west. That's all I knew. But we spent a few months in a city near the border, which in Hungarian is called Sopron, and in German Oedenburg. It was that close to Austria that it had two names. Just like, for instance, Bratislava used to be called Pressburg, because it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which of course ceased after 1924, when, well, actually by the end of First World War, the empire was dissolved, but it wasn't official until 24, when the peace treaty was, the peace treaty in Versailles, which was sort of the a real tragic date for all Hungarians, because they still remember this, but I'm digressing and I shouldn't, but so we were in this border area, and we were in a hotel, and it was December 6th, and the reason I remember that is because it was St. Nicholas Day. St. Nicholas is celebrated not around Christmas time, but it's in early December. And it was early in the morning, maybe 10 or 11 o'clock. It was bright blue sky and sun. And my parents, and there was some other people there as well, were looking out the window, and they saw from far little diamond specks glistening in the sky. And lo and behold, maybe 5 or 10 seconds later, the sirens went on. And of course, I was the first one, let's go, let's go. By the time we got down to the first floor, the airplanes were coming so close that you could hear glass rattle. But we made it down to the shelter, And those were probably some of the most harrowing moments of my young life. We were huddled together. I remember my mother's arms around my ears and my shoulder, because it was whenever planes fly really low, big planes, it makes a horrendous sound. I've never heard it since then, but that sound is still with me. So, and then there was a tremendous impact and a thud, and then there was a let up, and then it would come back. And so it went maybe for 15 minutes.
Do you remember which forces were coming in the planes?
Well, yeah, it was the Allied forces. It was, yeah. I think in particular, I think it was English, but it was the Allied, yeah. You know, they were doing their job, what they had to do. This is such a paradox in war, that you have to, you know, maybe they hated to do what they were doing, but they went into the war and they were doing their duty. And I think we could be pondering over that for a long time, you know, the justice. And they had a mission. So then finally this whole scenario repeated itself again, the planes flying. And then there was a tremendous shock and the force, and you know, everybody was, I don't know, I remember crying, and it was a mixture of crying and praying. And then it let up and somebody opened the door, and again sunlight came in, and we stepped outside, and maybe 40 feet away from the door where we came in the courtyard, there was an incredible crater. When a bomb falls, there is a huge crater when it misses the target, right? It missed the building, and there was the crater, and it fills up with water. And lo and behold, on top of the crater, I saw my sister's doll's clothes. And how that got there is a mystery. It was probably that the windows had broken upstairs, and some impact, something blew it out of the room, and it landed in that sea of destruction and that crater. That is something I'll never forget.
So briefly, from Hungary, will you please let us know where you traveled to after the war?
So when we left Sopron, we traveled in cars. We had my parents, my sister, some relatives, my aunt, and others. We were in these two cars, and we got as far as the actual border. And then it seemed to me that whatever we had, the cars, our luggage, our instruments, my violin, my mom's violin, it was confiscated, and the bare minimum we could take with us. And after maybe a couple of hours of waiting around, they shoved us in a train. And the trouble was, we didn't know where the train was going. We didn't know if it was going east or west. So we had been under, the train was going through, by that time we were in Austria proper, but if you probably remember from your history class, Austria at that time, as was Hungary, was under the Axis powers. So in other words, it was the German Reich spread out its tentacles, and we were unfortunately engulfed in that. But the SS people were ruthless. They just took everything away. They treated you like cattle, like you hear of descriptions. What they did was juice during, they just shoved, okay, it wasn't that bad. They didn't literally shove us into wagons, but it was a normal train passenger train. But still, it was a frightening moment. So then my father recognized, as we were going through the countryside, and also I must include that bombs were falling during the time, and my dad recognized the steeple of a church in Austria, and that's how we knew that we were in Austria and not in further east from Austria. So, because always going east, you think of going towards Russia or thereabouts. So we were in Austria going towards Germany. It was, the city's name was Rosenheim. Literally translated means the home of roses. So that's how we got to Germany, and we lived in Germany for 7 years. I went to school there, and life became somewhat more normal, although after the war it was hard to get basic necessities, and we were lucky in that respect that we were not in a camp with other refugees. We were in a village on the second floor of the schoolhouse where the school was. I mean, mind you, school consisted of one big room, and upstairs was a more or less normal living quarters that we shared with the bachelor school teacher, and we had a kitchen. I don't remember if there was a bathroom, but not like with a bathtub or anything like that, just a john, and you know, minimum comfort, but okay. And one bedroom that at least four of us slept in. And yeah, that's where we lived, and life went on. My sister went to into the nearby city to the high school, and I was in the elementary school underneath where we lived, and started studying violin with my mom. Well, actually, I'd started that at back home in Budapest already. So, but it was all very sporadic.
To clarify, how old were you during this transition between Hungary and Germany?
Well, I was probably, well, I know exactly. Actually, I was 6. And the reason I remember is that during this horrific train ride, we stopped somewhere. The train stopped. We didn't know where. It was like in a very small rural place. And there was like, it almost looked like, in today's language, I would describe it as maybe as a refugee aid station or something like that. And they were handing out milk to kids under 6 years old. And my mother says, go and get some milk. And I said, no, I can't. I'm 6. I'm already old. I can't lie. She said, just be quiet, just go there, tell them you're not quite 6. So finally, with great difficulty, it really bothered me, my first lie. But my mother said I should do it, so I did. And so that, I remember I was 6 years old.
Well, so you mentioned that your mother played violin. Music has been a tremendous influence in your life from the beginning. And so was it your mother who interested you in the violin and got you started?
You know, I don't really know why she did it, but I think she told me, and actually I remember when I was maybe like 2 or 3 years old, we had the shoe trees, you know. You know what shoe trees are?
I do not.
Shoe trees are little sticks that you bend and put into shoes after you take them off, so to preserve their shape. And this shoe tree on one end had some kind of metallic wrapper so that it made noise, and I used to take one shoe tree in my left hand and the other one in my right hand, and I pretended it was the violin. And maybe based on that notion, my mother thought that I was interested in the violin, which it turned out that I did. I did like it, yes. And I mean, I grew up with, you know, the classic violin repertoire, hearing Bach sonatas, and Corelli La Folia, I remember, was one of my favorite pieces.
And your mother was classically trained. What did she perform?
My mother was a graduate of Hubei. I don't know if you're familiar with that name, but he was a famous director of the National Conservatory in Budapest, and he was also a composer, and there is one piece that we still have, that Zephyr, you know, the wind Zephyr. It's spelled Zephyr, and it's a very cute violin piece. Every once in a while, it's still performed. So anyway, my mother had a very distinguished teacher, and yes, she did play. She played chamber music, and I remember her playing a sonata recital in Germany. And she played Spring Sonata and a Mozart Sonata and a Hindemith Sonata in E flat. Comes back all of a sudden.
And the Spring Sonata is by Beethoven.
Right, right.
Okay. Well, continuing on, when you first came to America, did you come, you did not come through Germany, I understand. You were living elsewhere?
No, we did live in Germany. We lived in southern Germany. And in the meantime, we lost my father. And we needed to move on. It was very hard for my mother to gain employment in Germany. And she needed to, at that point, she realized that she had to bring us up alone, and she did have a part-time position, played as a substitute violinist in the Bavarian Radio Orchestra in Munich for some time. And but my aunt had already arrived to South America at that time, and so we were talking now about maybe 51 or 52, and she urged my mother to emigrate to South America, to Colombia, and she thought that it was would be a great place for us. So after some to-do with the how to get there, and we managed to get across. I was in the sick bay for the whole trip from Italy to South America because my sister contracted trench mouth, and it's an infectious ailment, and had they noticed it before boarding the boat, they wouldn't have let us on, but she put up a good show, and she acted like she was fine, and she recovered very soon. But I caught it, and the doctor on board of the big Italian transport ship, was called Uso di Mare, was really angry at my mother that she brought a sick child on board. He said that, what am I going to do with her if she dies? And my mother was horrified, of course, about the possibility of something like that happening, but I was sick, but actually I was better off in the sick bay than being with 50 other women in the bowel of the boat, because this was not a luxury ship, but a refugee transport. But we made it to South America, and we arrived there in December. And I remember Christmas service, the first December we were there. We were there in fluffy summer dresses and all that. And when we were up in the choir loft, they were, instead of the beautiful religious music that they played in churches in Germany, we were hearing Strauss waltzes played with maracas, the typical Latin percussion instrument, and it was a culture shock, a difficult one.
And from Colombia, you came to America. What brought you to America?
Well, I was 17 years old by that time, and a member of the Colombian, the Orquesta Sinfónica Nacional, means the Colombian State Orchestra. I got into it somehow by hook or by crook when I was 15 years old, and I still wanted to study because I realized that it wasn't good enough. And the opportunity came, somebody, a very nice Jewish family, had a relative in Hartford, Connecticut, who had a child, and this child was a child prodigy. She was a violinist, and supposedly she had an outstanding teacher. They were from Romania, and they communicated to us then that they would happy to welcome me for a time if I would want. And they sent me all the necessary papers from the music school where I should register, and so it was set in motion. And in September of 1955, I came to Connecticut, and this was the school, and I was very lucky.
And the school was the Hart Conservatory?
Hart School of Music of the University of Hartford, later incorporated in the university.
When you first arrived in America, what went through your mind? What were your first impressions?
It was overwhelming. It was overwhelming. I mean, you know, America is every immigrant's dream. This is where I can make a beginning. This is where I'm not going to be discriminated against because I'm a foreigner or I'm this or that. And even though I was only 17 years old, I was acutely aware of that. And I was just very, very grateful. But I remember the car trip from the airport to Connecticut. I was astounded by the highways, by the roads.
One second.
So, where were we? Coming to America, yeah. Land of everyone's dreams. And so we drove to Connecticut, and it was difficult. Because as when I arrived to Colombia, there I also had trouble with the language. I didn't speak very fluent Spanish, hardly any. And then
okay. You were describing your first impressions of America.
Right. It's an overwhelming experience when you arrive into the land that you've been trying to get in. It was not easy. The only reason why I finally got a temporary student visa was because my mother, in the meantime, became a Colombian citizen, and that facilitated my paperwork also, because we were stateless until then, and it was very difficult to get a visa into the States, no matter whether you were a student. But anyway, I was finally there, And, you know, I made a great effort to do as well as I could, because I know that it was a great sacrifice for my mother just to put up the money that it cost for the trip alone. And she gave me a little bit of money, but I was lucky thereafter that I earned all of my little tuition I had to pay. Most of it, I got a scholarship. And I was lucky to right away get into the Hartford Symphony. And I was able to do all other little community orchestra jobs, and so I supported myself.
Okay. And at the Hart Conservatory, you studied violin performance?
I did, violin performance. And every once in a while, by the end of the week, I was discouraged and exhausted, and I said, no, I'm going to study something else like music history. That's another area, a subject that I really liked, and to this day I love music history. But then when I became less discouraged about the violin, I continued with the violin.
And who did you study with?
My teacher was Raphael Bronstein. He was of the Russian school, and I adored the man. I absolutely adored him. And his daughter also taught. She was quite a well-known violinist in those days, Ariana Brunn. She was also a great teacher. We became close friends. I was honored that she considered me not only a student, but a friend. And we have kept in touch even after I left the school. And I used to go back to New York at least once a year to visit Mr. Bronstein. But then finally he passed away. And we talk about him quite a bit. Greg met him once, and we took him, and he played for him.
And Greg is your oldest son and my fiancé.
Yeah.
And when did you first hear about the Detroit Symphony Orchestra? I understand that it was during your time in Connecticut.
Well, Mr. Bronstein, my teacher, told me one fine day, is that, you know, when you want to go somewhere, let me know, because they're always sending me letters that we have openings. And and so one day he told me that, he said, they're begging me for a violinist, and I'm sure that they weren't begging him for a violinist, but that meant that there is the opportunity to go and audition. So and this is after many years in Hartford, and I had in the meantime earned my bachelor degree and a master of music degree in performance, so it was time for me to move on. And we had a symphony concert in the evening one day, and a friend of ours, there were two of us, and I don't even remember the other person, but we borrowed the car of a boyfriend. The car was running, but just barely, and there was a big hole in the floor. And so it was freezing cold, it was early spring, and we arrived in New York at 3 in the morning. I was really not feeling well, and so I had a few hours sleep and went for my audition in the Wellington Hotel. In those days, there were no blind auditions, there were no committees. There were two people. One was the music director, and the other one was the personnel manager. Okay? That is if you're lucky, because sometimes it was only the music director. So anyway, it was Sixten Ehrling and Zinovy Bystritsky. And so I played there, and I didn't play too well, but I played anyway. And I remember the pieces I played. I played the Bach Preludium and Mendelssohn Concerto and then the orchestra excerpts, and I only played one or two orchestra excerpts, and Erling stopped me and he says, if we offer you the job, will you take it? And I looked at him amazed, and the first thing I said, why would I be auditioning if I'm not going to take it? I really couldn't understand why he would. And then later I found out, because typically people audition and see if they can make it, and then they don't take the job, which is sort of ridiculous to me. But anyway, I said, yeah, sure, I'll take it. And then later that afternoon, I also went and played for Vladimir Golshman. Now, that's probably a name that you don't remember. He was music director at that time of the Denver Symphony. This is before the Denver Symphony folded. Okay, and I played for him, and he wanted me to sign a contract right away, and I said, I really can't do it. I have to think about it. And I said that I want to come to Detroit because I want to take lessons with Misha Mishakov. He says, and he used to be a violinist too. He says, no, I'll teach you. And I thought, I didn't really want that. But okay, so a few days later, I heard from Bystritsky that indeed I had gotten the job. And I was very happy.
Your first year in the symphony,
mm-hmm.
What was that like?
Well, I was nervous. I was nervous for quite a while. Like before every rehearsal, I would get butterflies, and I would arrive really early because I was nervous, and I tried my best. I practiced the parts really well, and you know, I was one of five women, and that makes it sort of difficult in other respects as well. And yeah, it was fantastic. I couldn't believe the sounds around me. I had never been in a major orchestra. I didn't know what it sounded like. Everything perfect, the intonation. Where I came from, it was a fairly good orchestra, and the school orchestra was so-so, but still okay. And then when you're in a major orchestra like that, and everyone is playing, there is no dead weight there. And so it was, I said, this is what I want to do.
And at the time, Mishakov was the concertmaster?
Mishakov was the concertmaster.
And the assistant concertmaster was Gordon Staples, correct?
The associate concertmaster was Gordon. And I remember the first time when I met him, he was, everyone was very nice, I must say, but Gordon in particular was very charming and debonair and very outgoing. He could make people feel very easy. He had that knack of knowing how to, the social graces, that he just said the right thing to somebody he sensed probably that I was somewhat timid. And yeah, he made me feel at ease and offered to if he can help in any way. And this was the first rehearsal, and I asked him that our bowings weren't correct, that if I could have some help, if I could go and get the right bowings. And he says, yeah, I'll talk to Eddie Kessner right away. Eddie Kessner was the principal second at the time, and he was the leader of the second violin section. And I said, excuse me, but I'm in the first violin section. I said that to Gordon, and he looked at me and he says, oh, I didn't know that. And so I took from that right away that since I was young and I was a woman, he just presumed that I would be playing second violin, whereas I had gotten into the first violin section, which meant a lot to me. And so it showed me his attitude towards women in orchestras. But, you know, this goes back to 1964, so it's understandable.
And 1964 was your first season.
Right.
The 64-65 season?
Correct, yes. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I understand that the symphony at the time played in Ford Auditorium, which mm-hmm. is sadly no longer with mm-hmm. us. What was the hall like? I've heard little snippets here and mm-hmm. there.
Well, when I came, I had heard prior to coming that this was a new hall. It was built in the 50s, middle of the 1950s, and it was after it was with the patronage of the Ford family that it was built, and it was a stunning new hall, and it was stunning when you looked at it from the outside. It was on the riverfront. What else could be more beautiful, with a big circular driveway, a big lobby in the front, just like the dream. But unfortunately, the hall itself was acoustically inferior. And it was not really just a concert hall. It was a multi-purpose auditorium. So it was great for conventions and for graduations and weddings, but it was not acoustically satisfying, and that made it very difficult.
And in comparison, you witnessed the grand reopening of Orchestra mm-hmm. Hall. What do you recall from the first time you saw the hall? Whether it was during construction or mm-hmm. when the orchestra first played, what went through your mind?
Well, it was very real what went through my mind, and you're probably going to laugh. But when we played our first concert, it was a noon concert, and on the stage of Orchestra Hall was before it was renovated. And there were holes in the ceilings and other places, and there were pigeons flying around, and it was quite extraordinary. It was, you probably know the history, that it was saved by the efforts of a group of dedicated and forward-looking individuals who realized the value of a jewel, and because of its history, it was built in a very short period of time when their famous music director, Gabrilowicz, was music director. So we had the experience with the pigeons, but when we played there, I think, if I remember correctly, we were playing part of the Haffner Symphony. It was, you know, amazing. Even in its dilapidated state that it was in, and it was really sad to see that it was neglected and what that does to a structure. I mean, you could somehow envision that it had real potential and the acoustics were phenomenal. So lucky for us, they renovated it with these visionary individuals like Paul Ganson and a few others from the orchestra, Mario De Fiore. And this impossible dream became reality, and that was fantastic.
So during your 50-year tenure with the orchestra, do you have a singular favorite director out of the principal directors of the orchestra?
Look, nobody is perfect, and there is no such a thing. Otherwise, they wouldn't be musicians. But some had all the, you know, great qualities as musicians. They had the skill, and they also happened to be nice people. And in my position, being by then the wife of the concertmaster, because Gordon, who was at the beginning of our interview associate concertmaster, he then became concertmaster in 1968. And so I had fortunately or unfortunately, the access to meeting music directors and socializing with them a little bit, be it for dinner or a chat or inviting them to our home and that sort of thing. And there was one in particular who we befriended just as an individual, apart from his musical expertise. This was Jerzy Semkov. And he came to Detroit to conduct for over 30 years, and Detroit audiences really loved him.
And was Semkov a principal director, or was he the assistant?
Unfortunately, he never had an official title. Yeah, but and then the other conductor who stands out in my memory as my main mentor, so to speak, someone with whom there was never a moment of dullness, and there was always something that I could learn from him, and so could everyone else, and that was Antal Duraty. Yeah, he was really an extraordinary musician, cultured individual, and there wasn't one rehearsal ever that I didn't go home and could think, yes, I didn't know this, I learned this, and I learned that. But he was also a very difficult person. Difficult person who, even according to himself in his book, wrote and published a very lovely book to read, which I would recommend to you, Notes of Seven Decades. And he even states in that book that the only thing that he was never able to conquer was his temper. And the orchestra musicians suffered the brunt of that.
Well, as well as your time with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, you also worked with Motown Records.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. And what do you recall from your time working with Motown?
Well, it was a venture into something that was totally new to me in particular, because I came from a European background, even though I lived in the United States since I was 17 years old, those formative years being absorbed by German culture were really left sort of formed what my value system in music and culture. So it was a little bit difficult for me to accept that genre of popular music, but it was almost contagious, the enthusiasm, it was really Detroit. It was the culture of Detroit, of its people, and the stars of those days became icons of popular culture. And not only here in America. For instance, just a few years ago, maybe since I've been retired, I did an interview with somebody from Great Britain. They had a survey all through the British Isles about which is their favorite Motown tune. I mean, they to this day love Motown music. So that's really amazing. Yeah, and what was it like? So we were the strings that sort of added interest in the orchestration, not just to have rhythm section, but to have something a little bit more interesting. So it was, we were in a way sort of the, if you want to say maybe the bridge between the long-haired symphony musicians and the more hip part of society and their music. So, yeah, we had sessions mostly after symphony concerts, really late at night, and we were, they had a track, and it was, we had beeps in the phones, so we would cover one ear to hear the beep and leave the other ear open from the headphones so we could hear ourselves play, because as you know, you being a violinist, it's pretty hard to play without hearing yourself. Yeah? So we had the track, the beep, and most of the time when we first started recording it, we would just hear the beep. And yeah, Gordon was leading us sort of, and we would go through the charts, and they were difficult for the most part. Very difficult, very well written too. But they were young arrangers at that time, and we all learned as we went along. They learned how to, that for a string player it's better to write a tune in D major rather than in D flat, because for us to play with zillions of flats, you know, when you don't have one open string left on the instrument and it's all fingered, it's very unpleasant and very difficult.
Yes, and one of the arrangers was David Van de Pit, mm-hmm. who I understood, mm-hmm. understand became a very close family friend. Yeah. What was your collaboration with David like?
David was one of the very talented, along with a couple of others who I remember by name. David was very, very talented arranger and orchestrator. He had a real knack for writing very beautiful, lush string parts. Very nice. He had a feeling for it. And it's surprising because he actually was a trombone player rather than a string player. But he had that talent. He felt it. He used to play in bands. Yeah, I think, if I'm not wrong, he played in the Jimmy Dorsey band as a young man. He traveled with them. And he was also a composer who wrote other serious music. We played a string quartet by him one time, and he also wrote a lovely violin piece that Greg played at his memorial service. Beautiful little piece. Yeah, so he was a composer as well. And then later, after Motown years, we had some very fruitful collaboration where he hired a group of strings. He had some other work from other people, and so we had a long history together.
I understand that Gordon, as the concertmaster of the Detroit Symphony, mm-hmm. and working with Motown, he released his own album, right. Called The String Thing.
Yeah.
Do you recall anything from that project?
Yes, I recall. I see. I envision the picture that is. It's sort of a crazy picture where it's in the backdrop of a violin, and everybody is acting goofy and stuff like that. But if you will look at the picture carefully, I'm missing from that picture. And the reason being is that I was pregnant, and again, they did not want to have a pregnant woman sitting there. It was so that was also the summer where I had, this was in 1970, about 3-4 months prior to the birth of my first son, and the Detroit Symphony released me from all duties. They didn't want me on stage of Meadowbrook in the summer, even though in those days women did not emphasize their child to be born, but wore tents around them. But No, I did not think that it was, part of that bohemian atmosphere of that record jacket for me to be sitting there. But I did play some of the tunes, actually, but I'm not on the record jacket.
To fast forward a little bit through the decades, the DSO had some labor disputes between the unions and the management, the most prominent of those being the 2011 strike. Would you share a few memories from that time, please?
Yeah, well, that was a very bitter dispute. Very difficult period, and of course it wasn't exactly surprising and it wasn't anything new for me, because we had experienced through our whole existence since day one that I came to Detroit. Every 3 years our stomachs were upset and the anxiety grew to a feverish pitch. Are we going to have a job next year? Is the symphony going to fold? There was fear-mongering and yet also realistic concern, because after all, music is a luxury. Even I think it's a necessity, but some people consider it as a luxury. It's not like, you know, firefighters and building cars. That's a necessity of life. But I think culture should be, like in Europe, it's sponsored by the state, but in America it is not. And so that was difficult, but never had the outlook been so bleak. And it was the mindset of management that that was really concerning that this time they really mean it and it's going to be very difficult. They wanted, this was not just with us, it was a whole movement across the spectrum of American symphony orchestras. And it was very difficult, very divisive. Up until that negotiation, this was a very unified orchestra, and that unity gave us strength. And at that point, when we went on strike, slowly that strength was eroding. There were fissures. Yes, do I pronounce that correctly? Fissures. Cracks in this strength. So there were different factions in the orchestra. And, you know, when I look back, I can understand it. There were young people who came from the conservatory. They were not concerned with what came before them. So in a way, I don't hold it against them. And yet, I regret that so many of my colleagues, who I respect deeply, couldn't stand to be part of the organization anymore. They either retired or left the organization, went somewhere else. So it was very sad, because part of the DSO, the tradition of all the music directors and all that, went away. And some of our, you know, very finest musicians left, and some retired prematurely. So that was sad. But, you know, I think music is going to win in the long run. And from the ashes we arose, right? And we have a beautiful new refurbished hall, and with facilities. In the first few years, I forgot to mention, after we moved into the hall, there were, by that time, we had maybe 15 women already in the orchestra, and we had one tiny little dressing room, and then had to go up on stairs to the stage. Anyway, so now we have the beautiful new hall with a huge atrium, lobby, all the amenities that you could want. And the musicians are doing fairly well, not as well as they would like, but, you know, they are playing music to make a living.
In the 2014-2015 season, you made the decision to retire after 50 years. Do you have a favorite memory from that season?
Well, it was a difficult decision, but I had been thinking about it, and I knew that there has to be an end. There are too many unemployed young musicians who need to be there, who need every spot counts, and but it was difficult, and I think the highlight for me was, of course, was the last concert, because it was such a beautiful, stirring piece of music that I absolutely loved, the Mahler Third Symphony, and on top of it, I got to sit with my favorite step partner, my son. So, but earlier I wanted to mention during the question you asked me about highlights of my career with other music directors, that one moment that stands out in my mind, when we went on the 79 European tour with Dorati, we played in Berlin. At that time it was still a divided city, the West and East, although the cracks in the wall were showing there, and that those cracks were good because the wall came tumbling down. But so there we were, a symphony orchestra from Detroit, basically an industrial town still known as the car capital, and so this is an orchestra from the industry of the Midwest of America, and we played in Berlin, and we played two pieces, one piece Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, which is a staple of the Germanic core repertoire, and the other one was the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra. So there was an American orchestra and a Hungarian conductor playing in Berlin, and it was an absolutely stunning reception. We were applauded for 45 minutes. The orchestra played encores, two or three encores. We finally left the stage and people were still applauding. So Dorati came and brought individual musicians out and taking a bow. I mean, you want to acknowledge the applause of the audience and thank them, but, you know, we had to leave also. It was an absolutely unforgettable experience, because of the quality of the music making and also the reception, the acceptance by the German public.
Bee, this was an amazing treat for me. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Hope that the technical parts work out.
Me too. Me too. Thank you.